Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 10 of Secrets and Spies, and this is Espresso Martini, and I'm Chris, obviously, and if you don't know who I am, I'm Chris. I'm the co-host and kind of creator of Secrets and Spies, and I'm with Matt here. Matt, how are you?
I'm good. I am for anyone, any newbies or whatever, people who were away for a while and came back after several years, and they're like, who is this strange voice on the mic? I'm Matt. I'm the American half. Good to be back with you, Chris. Yeah. I was setting everything up this morning, and I'm like, what are we? How do I do this? What plug goes where?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
No, it's good to be.
I can totally relate to that. Yeah. No, I was trying to figure out how to use, because we use this app called Riverside to connect with each other, and I couldn't remember how to do certain little things on it. A bit rusty on the tech side, but hopefully we're sharp on the more important things.
Yes.
But it's been, as always, so we always take a production break in August, and usually in August is when all hell breaks loose. And it wasn't too bad this August, but quite a lot happened. Yeah.
We got lucky, I think. I wouldn't say that no hell broke loose over the month. I certainly wouldn't say that. But as far as like something that would really necessitate us coming back in August, there really wasn't anything, nothing that we couldn't discuss today.
Because I remember the death of Prigozhin 2 summers ago now, wasn't it? Was one of the events where we were like, uh-oh, should we come back on?
Last year, there was the Lebanon Hezbollah stuff with the pagers and the beavers and everything. And that happened like right as we were coming back, that happened. But that was also,
So please, everybody on the world stage, could you calm down in August so then we can all have a break?
Launch your coups and your military operations, your unexpected military operations, your coups, your revolutions, your peoples. Do that in September.
Yes, indeed. But I suspect they probably all wait till August, because not because we're off air, but because maybe most of the world leaders are all having a holiday, as if people think they can get away with it.
That's true. I mean, there was always that running joke when like when Obama went away to Martha's Vineyard or something in like August, there was always something that went down while he was away, always.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. And I certainly think with the first story we're going to talk about in a minute, I have a bit of a pet theory that maybe this all happened over the summer because that's when people have time on their hands. And also it's a great time to maybe influence people because there's so many people who are on holiday who are suddenly reading things that maybe they don't usually read,
right,
which is a great time to kind of get into people's subconscious. So, you know, there's my theory for something I'm about to talk about in a moment.
But yeah, well, let's get into that if you'd like. Yeah. What do we yeah. have up today?
Well, yeah, so we've got quite a few interesting stories. So our first one will be about, it'll be from the UK, and it's a weird story about the increase of flags suddenly appearing in the UK, which on one level appears a bit innocent and maybe a bit patriotic, but actually there's something a little bit more sinister behind that. Then our next story is one that you picked, and it'll be about the US offers for intelligence and air support for Ukraine once it achieves either a ceasefire or a peace deal with Russia. Then we've got an interesting one about the tensions between Tulsi Gabbard and the CIA chief. And then we'll be wrapping up with a story from New Zealand, a kind of spy scandal from New Zealand. So hopefully quite a nice jam-packed episode for everybody today. So I'll get us going with the first story. So over the summer in the UK, there has been an increase in anti-immigrant talking points specifically aimed at migrant boats crossing across the English Channel. Then over the last couple of weeks across the UK, we've seen lampposts suddenly adorned with St George's Cross, England flags and Union Jacks. And typically, you only see these flags come out for a special occasion of national significance, for example, a major sporting win or a royal birthday, like the Platinum Jubilee that happened, or D-Day, Remembrance Sunday. Those kind of events are where you would typically see bunting with usually Union Jacks and the odd St. George's Cross. But this recent show of national flags actually appears to have a slightly more sinister origin. So I'm going to look at an article by Joe Mulhorn for Hope Not Hate, and it's all about Operation Rise the Colours, which is organised by well-known far-right extremists. Surprise, surprise. So Union Jacks and St George's Crosses have been appearing on lampposts across the UK. While some see this as simple patriotism, Hope Not Hate reveals much of the campaign is driven by organised far-right activists. The campaign called Operation Raise the Colours is led by Andrew Curran, who is also known as Andy Saxon. He is a longtime ally of Tommy Robinson, and he is the head of security for Britain First. Curran has a violent past. In 2009, he was jailed for his role in a brawl that resulted in a racist killing of a 59-year-old man. In Nottingham, local activity is led by a man called Gurmit Singh, who is a former senior member of the EDL and has a conviction for armed robbery. While Britain First leader Paul Golding has claimed his group donated the most flags now flying in Manchester and Birmingham. To add to the mix, football hooligan groups and far-right online networks have been encouraging their members to take part, turning what looks like a grassroots campaign into a coordinated national effort. Flying the national flag obviously is not illegal and is not inherently extremist, but with convicted racist and far-right groups leading the charge, Operation Raise the Colours does raise serious questions about the true motivations behind this wave of activism. So Matt, I don't know what your thoughts are on this sort of very English story that sort of kicked off.
It is a very English story, and for that reason, I thought as we were prepping for this, it was probably best for me to sort of take more of a back seat on this one and let you do the driving here before I say something that I shouldn't.
okay. Well, I know there's a very big difference in flag culture.
There is. I was gonna say that.
So maybe talk to us a bit about the American flag culture, and then I'll see where the English one kind of fits
in. This is a cultural difference between our countries. There aren't many of them, and what cultural differences there are, I think they're pretty kind of superficial, you know. Mm, mm. But this is certainly one of them. I know, and again, as you've said in your intro, and as the article states a couple of times, you know, flying your national flag is not inherently a far right gesture or something. There's something wrong with that, and it shouldn't be a far right gesture. And I think it's important that those symbols are not allowed to become that way. But there, my understanding of it there sort of has been in the UK, flying a Union Jack, especially St. George's Cross, which is for any, you know, American listeners, that's the Union Jack is the flag of the UK. Of Great Britain. The St. George's Cross is the white background red cross. That's sort of the English, the English flag. There's been, it's the connotation is to fly a Union Jack or a St. George's Cross, especially, has more nationalistic far right connotations. And I think that's something, people will disagree on that, and that's fine. My understanding of it as an outsider was that that had more of a nationalist connotation in the UK than it does flying an American flag here, which is more, I would say, if you're just flying an American flag outside of your house, I have one flying in front of my house right now. I'm certainly not far right and not a fan of the current administration. I fly it because I consider myself a patriot, and I don't think that, you know, why would you surrender that symbol to those sorts of people, you know? So that's my reasoning for it, but it doesn't, I want to say that flying an American flag here, just a regular old American flag, it's almost, it's essentially apolitical here. It just means that you're flying the flag, and there's no issue with that. But maybe I'll let you go into more of the complexities over there about
Well, so the St. George's Cross, unfortunately, has become very much associated with nationalists and racist nationalists. Now, nationalism itself is a very wide term. Nationalism in some ways is not terrible, but in some ways it gets very bad because it becomes sort of exclusatory. So you want kind of you want some sort of inclusive nationalism, which means you know, that if you apply to live in this country and you get British citizenship, you know, you are now a citizen of the country. That's how it should work, and you may wish to fly a flag to celebrate that, and that shouldn't be a problem. But unfortunately, I think something has happened, or maybe something has always been the case in British, maybe leftist culture, where increasingly we've become more and more suspicious of using the flags ourselves, and become more unpopular, uncomfortable using the flags ourselves. And unfortunately, then that's allowed room, like you said earlier, for then the far right or these right wing groups to kind of use the flag for their own benefit. And there's no kind of counter narrative to it. So, and it's more so with the St. George's Cross. I would say flying the Union Jack is a little bit less problematic. And I say problematic, it shouldn't be problematic, but it kind of is a little bit. I think in the UK, like where I grew up in leafy Surrey, it kind of felt like it was unnecessary to fly the flag, if you know what I mean, except for special occasions.
I've heard it described that way. It seems a bit like it's insisting upon itself, or at least that's how it would be seen, again, by, I think we're talking a lot of like a left, center left perspective.
So where I grew up, which was in, you know, conservative Surrey, in my neighborhood of 30 houses, only one house erected a flagpole and put a flag up, and a man would put it up every morning. You know, he had this little private ceremony of his own where he'd actually put it up on a flagpole, a proper flagpole.
Revelry.
And take it down in the in the evening. So I'm like, so that's sort of like, to me, that always felt a bit odd.
If he's like military.
I don't know. I didn't know him very well, to be honest, whoever that neighbor was. But that was something that used to happen and would cause amusement for a lot of people. But then, like my dad, who I would describe as very nationalistic and very patriotic and proud of Britain, the only flag we had was one that we got in a free newspaper for the Olympics. And then it ended up being put in a in the front window in a vase for flowers, and it just stayed there and kind of just slowly faded, but it was just there. It wasn't even bought, it was given to us for the Olympics, and then it kind of just stayed there. So there was no concerted effort to go and buy a flag, put it up on the house, and have it adorned there every day, so when you walk through, you know, you're in England, kind of thing. So it just sort of feels a bit unnecessary. So it definitely, with the this kind of situation now where you're driving down the road of many parts of Britain, and it's not just in London. So over the holidays, my wife and I did a few day trips to different places, and suddenly go through small towns, and there you are, these, you know, endless this row of lampposts are all adorned with the St. George's cross, mainly, less so the Union Jack or the Union flag. I've lost track now whether we call it the Union Jack or Union flag. It's been a few years since I've really even talked about the flag. So I need to remind myself at some point what the correct term is. But Union Jacks are traditional, and I think Union flags the more politically correct way to put it. But so suddenly it feels a bit intimidating, and it kind of reminded me of last year, when suddenly in East London there were a load of Palestinian flags adorned on lampposts all across certain parts of East London. And what you can tell immediately is it's a coordinated effort. Yeah. And then you have to ask yourself, what is the goal of this coordinated effort to suddenly, out of nowhere, you wake up in the morning and your entire street is covered in flags? And it's not been sanctioned by an official government body, you know, so the local council haven't put them up, the government haven't said, you've got to put flags up, not that any government has ever said that. And also, usually when people put flags up for special occasions, it's in bunting form, which is these sort of weird triangles that are connected onto strings, which you kind of hold up. And so, again, it's not a proper flag. It's sort of a version of the flag. So it does sort of feel a bit intimidating suddenly, and a bit odd when you suddenly see your entire street covered in flags. It's sort of created this sort of weird feeling at the moment, and it does feel like it's designed to intimidate. And now with Hope Not Hate's investigation revealing that there's, no great surprise to me that there's a far-right group has initiated this. And it comes off the back of, there's been a rise in protests recently about migrant boats. And what's kind of caused this is the current government, and also the Conservative government, use hotels to house asylum seekers who are going through the application process. And the problem is they do it in such a way where it doesn't, it kind of doesn't involve the local council. A hotel just suddenly gets taken over by the government. Obviously they pay the hotel, they block book the hotel. They don't just like take it, they don't like send in the army and take it over, but they block book this hotel for a period of time, pay fixed rates for the rooms, and then house, these people in as they're being processed. And then the thing is twofold things sort of happen. People get bent out of shape because nobody's been consulted, which is part one. Part two is nobody knows who those people are going in. And then sadly, part three, then people assume the worst. And I've noticed then, like with the rhetoric that happened with the hotel in Farringdon, which is not far from me, people instantly were claiming that, with not knowing who any of these people were, that the hotel was all men, that they're a danger to women, and that they're all going to claim off benefits and be a kind of burden on the economy. And all of that is not true. So number one, yes, okay. So most of them in the hotel, I think, in Farringdon were all men in the end. So fine, that did happen. But then to assume that they're all kind of sex pests who are going to endanger women or criminals, etc. I mean, crikey, that's just so cynical. There may be one or two who might be problematic, but hey, we live in a city. How many crimes and murders are committed by locals every day? Do you know what I mean? You can't... to say exclusively that this hotel full of men suddenly means they're all kind of rampant racists is just outrageous. And then also the benefits argument. Well, asylum seekers don't actually get benefits. They get I think they get £80 a week or something, and that's it, just to get them sort of going. So it's under scrutiny, a lot of the talking points don't actually hold up. And it's very sad that, what we're seeing at the moment is the far right are trying to push this agenda through, because I think the goal is the 2029 election in the UK. And, we've talked about this before, the winds that brought Trumpism to America are now blowing very hard in the UK. And I kind of feel like this flag effort is kind of like the cherry on the cake of the far right in the over their summer efforts to influence people. So as I was saying at the top of the show, I think they'd, because when I look at last summer, we had those riots that happened. And again, it all kind of happened during the summer. Now, yes, it was potentially, it was sparked off by the Newport stabbing. So there may be a coincidental thing, but I'm wondering if this summer was much more intentional because they feel like they can influence people. And also because Parliament's in recess, there's less likely to be any kind of major government pushback until this, till the autumn, which is now. So I don't know, it's a very messy picture, but it's amazing how this sort of flag thing really has sort of become representative of so many sort of negative things recently. And it's very sad.
I think as far as the debate that you're having about migration and everything, and I think that debate for you guys is going to continue for years to come. And unfortunately, I think the worst of it has not yet come, that you will experience over there in the years ahead. It's more of a, that's a much longer conversation. As far as what's happening here with these far right groups that Hope Not Hate spells out is behind these, on the surface, very innocuous kind of efforts. I think it's a trap that the far right lays often. You know, they'll put out flags, just flags, right? National flags, right? Be patriotic, be proud of your country, right? Be, you know, embrace that, right? That's a very kind of normal, sensible thing that almost, I think, the vast majority of people wouldn't have any issue with, right? So you put it out there and then you wait for people on the left or, you know, media types, activist types to sort of complain about it and cry afoul of the reasoning behind it. And then that debate gets twisted into, well, you're not patriotic. Why do you hate the flag? You know, that's not right, which isn't true. And what these people are trying to use that flag as a symbol for, I think, is really, you know, harmful and not great. I would, this came up, I remember, months ago when we had the big No Kings protest movement here, all over the country. There was, and this sort of also came up, some of the protests and the riots, in LA, months ago. There was discussion again from activists and stuff on the left who were trying to say that, you know, flying an American flag at an anti-Trump protest is like, you shouldn't do that because that's like a sign of fascism. And I just can't, gut reaction to that is just like, please touch grass and never speak again, lest you give Fox News more ammunition, you know?
Yeah.
Again, that's why I have just a regular old American flag in front of my house. Like you don't have the right to that symbol. You don't get to hijack it. You don't get to dictate what it means according to your, you know, political beliefs, I think. My advice, I guess, to y'all over there looking at this would be to embrace it yourselves, embrace the flag yourself, and don't let them have it.
Yeah, I think that's wise. And it's interesting as well, because I remember last summer when Sir Keir Starmer and Labour, he became the Prime Minister and Labour became the government. Suddenly again on the left, there was criticisms of him wanting to use the Union Jack more, because the left always in right wing.
Yeah. Don't do that.
No, exactly, because the right love painting the left as unpatriotic, and so and it becomes this stupid debate that, quite frankly, is not necessary. It doesn't really achieve anything. But suddenly telling the Prime Minister you shouldn't have the Union Jack behind you, I think, is completely ridiculous. And this is one of the issues, not the issue, but I think, as you were saying, the left need to take ownership of the flag again and find a meaning in it for themselves. Now, my personal preference. I actually quite like the grey one the British Special Forces use. But I think you have to earn that one. But that's quite a cool version of it. And then I saw, unfortunately, some of the protesters, so that they were co-opting a lot of women into some of these protests against the migrants in the hotels. And I noticed a lot of the women were using pink versions of the Union Jack. So again, like, you know, people are, the far right are finding all sorts of ways to use the Union Jack. So I think the left need to do it. And I think there's a bigger debate here, which I'm going to only skirt a little bit on, that I want to do some episodes on over this season, about like how the kind of anti-colonial narratives that are kind of very much of the far left are kind of slowly, because of Trumpism and a reaction to kind of the rise of fascism and authoritarianism, are slowly trying to shift themselves into the center and become normalized, i.e. shift the Overton window. And the problem is, it's giving a lot of ammunition to the far right, who are also trying to shift the Overton window and push talking points. And the thing is, the majority of people are not nerdy about the topics that we talk about. The majority of people do want to go and do their job, come home, live their life, and not really care about what's going on in politics, because
they see people complaining about displays of the national flag and they're like, exactly. Well, why would you complain about that? That's not, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They don't react to the substance. They just see the headlines saying that leftists think the flying the flag is fascist or something.
Which is, if you're saying that it is, that's dumb, and don't say that.
Totally. But I can see it happen. I can see it, you know, I have seen it happen. And in fact, when we talk about New Zealand later, there's a little bit of that going on, in not with the flag, but there's some interesting stuff with the far right in New Zealand as well, where anti-colonial narratives are suddenly kind of disrupting social cohesion, should we put it that way? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's what's definitely happened in the United States, and I think is happening here. And I think us people of the more centre-left, who always get criticised, because again, a lot of people misunderstand centre-leftism in the sense of that they think that because the opposition now shifted things, that we need to shift a bit as well to meet them in the middle. And I was like, no, I think there are certain liberal values that you need to defend. And you need to call out whether the far left or the far right are trying to shift things. And at the moment, the far right are definitely aggressively, both in America and Britain, trying to shift things into the middle. And I'm seeing them succeed more than the far left are.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating. And it's definitely something I'm going to be investigating this season, because I am worried, very much so, that there's now a real possibility that Nigel Farage could become the prime minister, or close to becoming the prime minister in 2029.
Or a kingmaker for the prime minister, essentially.
Exactly, he could. So I think the very most likely scenario, the way I see it at the moment, I think I said this last time, is that I think a coalition government will be our next government. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea who that coalition will be, but it could be a Farage conservative one. It could be a Labour with maybe the Lib Dems or something. I don't know. Who knows? We can't predict the future, but there's definitely, certainly going by the polls at the moment, there's been a shift in Britain towards reform and reform talking points, and that concerns me. And you know, because I honestly, that does worry me, because I've seen what's going on in America, without being disrespectful, but I'm now worried it's definitely going to happen here. You know, we're going to see mass deportations and all this sort of stuff, or attempts at it.
Yeah,
and that's really worrying.
Yeah, you're not immune to the same virus. In fact, you already have it.
Yeah,
it's just not, it's still, you know, incubating.
Masticizing, whatever they, yeah, incubating, yeah.
Yeah, I would just say, I don't think anyone should have any issue with their national flag. If you want to fly a Union Jack or an American flag in front of your house, you should be able to do that. And that really, I think, says inherently nothing about your own politics. It just means you have pride for your country. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with that. Yeah, my advice, for the same reason I got an American flag in front of my house right now.
Yeah.
Don't let them have it.
No. Well, it's up to us to make our country what we want it to be. You know, if you think about, if we always dwell on all the past sins, we will disrupt the future in a negative way. It's a bit like interpersonal stuff. If you dwell on the past, you ruin the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think on some level, we've got to obviously have a, yeah, people want to have conversations about all of our problematic pasts, fine, but don't let it then become so ridiculous that it's disrupting the future. Yeah, because at the moment, all I see at this time is it disrupts elections and allows fascists to get in.
Yeah.
And it's not great. And if that's the legacy of the left, then frankly, they need to sort their shit out.
There's a lot of, this is a discussion where there's a lot of nuance and context that I think is necessary. Mm. And people do well.
Yes.
People do so well with that stuff now.
Well, the good thing is we've got a whole year to do that nuance and all that. Hopefully through some interviews with some hopefully mm-hmm. decent people, which we're working on at the moment over the year ahead. So, difficult. Sort of interesting and difficult times for Britain at the moment, and we will see what happens. But flag sales, I mean, it's probably a good time to be in the flag business, I guess.
Sure.
Maybe we should set up a link ourselves, you can buy flags for mm-hmm. our website or something.
Yeah,
there we go. Cool. Well, I think that's a good point to take a break, and then we'll be back for more. Hey everybody, it's Chris here. I hope you're well. Have you ever wanted to run one of your own podcasts? Well, on Monday the 22nd of September, I'll be running a one-day workshop with my friend Jeff, who runs a Doctor Who podcast called Who Corner to Corner. And we'll be looking at the basics of podcasting and empowering you to make your own podcast. So join us on Monday the 22nd of September. The link is in the show notes below.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody. So our next story is one that you picked out, Matt, about US offers for air and intelligence for Ukraine. And one just addendum, I guess, is obviously there are some things going on in Paris at the moment with regards to the future of Ukraine that, you know, we're going to keep an eye on as we have this discussion that may or may not lead to something that is breaking at the time of recording.
Yeah,
but by the time you hear it, might be like, oh, wow, that was so 2 days ago.
48 hours before this airs. With that, this is a moving target that we're talking about right now. There is stuff going on as we record that may or may not prove to be relevant. We'll, you know, touch on that a bit. We were talking about it before we started recording. We'll touch on that a bit as we go forward. But yes, moving target, all preliminary. I say that to from the start. So here's what we got. Last week, the Financial Times reported a potential major shift in Washington's posture towards post-war Ukraine. President Trump has told European leaders that the United States is prepared to play a supporting role in any European-led security guarantees, something Kyiv has sought to deter renewed Russian aggression once a deal is struck. According to senior officials, the U.S. would not deploy combat troops, but is now willing to provide what they call strategic enablers. So that's intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, or ISR, command and control, C2, and contributions to an air defense shield. That would mean U.S. aircraft, logistics, and ground-based radar helping enforce a European-run no-fly zone, potentially, over Ukraine and American satellite monitoring of a ceasefire. This marks a sharp turn from earlier in the year when the Trump administration flatly ruled out any U.S. role in post-conflict security guarantees. European officials say they've been lobbying hard for exactly this kind of commitment, admitting that any ground deployment, likely 4 to 5 brigades from a, quote, coalition of the willing led by the U.K. and France, would be untenable without American oversight and protection from the rear. The deal, however, is conditional. U.S. backing hinges on European capitals actually committing tens of thousands of troops to Ukraine, something still deeply controversial in many parliaments. And within Washington, Trump's own defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, remains skeptical, warning that guarantees could drag the U.S. into a future war. Meanwhile, Trump continues to push for a negotiated settlement between Moscow and Kyiv, but the two sides remain far apart, especially on territory and the question of who provides security guarantees. Vladimir Putin insists Russia must be included in any arrangement, which Kyiv considers a non-starter. So what's emerging is a layered concept, a demilitarized zone potentially patrolled by neutral peacekeepers, a Ukrainian military line reinforced with NATO-trained troops, and behind that, a European deterrence presence enabled and backstopped by American intelligence and air power. Zelensky's chief of staff called this a big change from the spring and said the U.S. can provide the backbone that makes the whole security architecture viable. For now, it's all pre-decisional, but the direction is clear. After months of hesitation, Washington is currently, I want to highlight that, currently signaling that while it won't send ground troops, it may still be indispensable to whatever European security framework comes next. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it is a very positive step. I will keep the champagne on ice at this point.
As we should.
Yeah, because I think the key phrase here, this is the phrase that keeps bothering me about all these speeches, even the Zelensky Macron discussion I just watched live just before this, is we're all talking about post-war. And this war ain't over yet.
Yep.
And this is the problem. Until this war ends, all these things which sound brilliant and I think are brilliant mean nothing. And this is the problem. And this is the sort of frustrating thing currently, because obviously there's a lot of real politics going on behind the scenes. There are questions about whether the Trump administration really has qualified people to deal with the real politics, because again, what was actually achieved in Alaska a few weeks ago, because the meeting now is looking more and more embarrassing for the US, and it's become more famous for US soldiers on their knees prepping a red carpet for Putin, yep, and a free air show and a ride in the Beast.
Yep.
Wouldn't we all love a ride in the Beast? Why the hell wasn't that there for Zelensky, you know, who's an ally, for crying out loud? I mean, yes, hell, why don't we start doing that all the time for all our allies, you know, rolling out the red carpet? Why is it a war criminal, a man who murders lots of people, gets all the star treatment? Now, I know, yes, we have to flatter Putin a little bit, and again, like that's just politics, you know.
Yeah,
but there's a way to do it. Like, I don't know, have a man with some champagne for him or whatever. You don't need a freaking air show. You know, the red carpet's there, but maybe don't get troops to put it down. Maybe you can get some civilian contractors to come in or whatever, or people at least dressed in suits who don't look like they're members of the American military. There are so many ways that could have been handled that optically look really bad, and it looked really bad in Kyiv. And then obviously Zelensky had a meeting with Trump backed by European allies, because I think everybody realized that Zelensky now needs a team of people who to protect him from Trump and the Vice President Vance, even though Vance was on holiday, I think, at that point. So it's all a bit, yeah, it's not great, but it could be great. You know, and then obviously the Trump administration, you know, it's got this problem in the sense of it has to appeal to its MAGA base, which is still quite largely pro-Russia. So I want to give Trump some credit quickly. It's just obviously negotiations with Russia are delicate, and there is a concern that the US makes the wrong move or overplays its hand, it could lead to catastrophe. But the problem is right now, the Trump administration has also underplayed its own hand by ruling out things such as NATO membership for Ukraine before the talks even started. So Matt, I'll hand over to you.
Yeah, I want to say the most recent poll that I saw on Trump voters' support of Ukraine, I believe they support Ukraine, the number is somewhere in the low to mid 50s.
Okay.
And that shifted once in recent months. Trump started saying he's unhappy with Putin, yada, yada, yada. He's got 2 weeks, you know, all of the issues about that, fair. But the shift came from that because he shifted. And I believe it's now currently in the mid to low 50s in their support, which isn't great. I mean, yeah, it should be much higher. And historically, you think Republican voters, it would be much, much higher. But that's where we are.
But it's a development, isn't it?
So, it's a development. Yeah, I'm just saying where we are. No, I think, again, everything, it's so hard to discuss this because, of course, you know, okay, this is what they say now, and that could change, I don't know, tomorrow.
Well, there's always a trap door, isn't there? You know, that's the problem with the Trump administration. There's always this sort of trap door feeling that tomorrow morning they could completely do a U-turn, as has happened with the tariffs, you know?
Yeah, they've done it on numerous things. So, I mean, I just bring this up to show what is being discussed sort of right now and the offer that was on the table, or at least being entertained. Looking at this deal as it is, I think it would be good. I think it would be useful. I think any sort of hypothetical peacekeeping force, poor post-war Ukraine, I don't think it's wrong to suggest that should be primarily led and stocked, should we say, by European militaries. I don't think that's an insane request. I think U.S. troops on the ground in Ukraine would be politically very difficult and would have been politically difficult under, say, Kamala Harris administration. You know, I think that would be, yeah, even if we were looking at a very different U.S. administration that was involved in these negotiations, I think U.S. boots on the ground in Ukraine for an undetermined period of time would be politically difficult to do. That said, as what this deal is describing as kind of American backstop to a European-led force focused on these strategic enablers, right, which is ISR, aerial refueling, logistics, satellite overhead, you know, support to monitor the ceasefire, where Russian forces are, can, you know, geolocate immediately any artillery or missiles that are fired from Russian lines, like immediate GPS fix on and knowing what was fired.
Oh yeah, the technology is breathtaking what you guys have got, really. It's yeah.
Yeah, we give the Ukrainians, and I believe it's distributed through NATO also. I can't imagine it wouldn't be, but US intelligence gives the Ukrainians daily a updated exact breakdown of all Russian air defenses inside Ukraine, like what system it is, exactly where it's located, updated every single day. So that's stuff that we could continue to provide. And those, you know, as we talk about with Europe increasing defense spending, rebuilding its armed forces following, you know, their drawdown after the Cold War, which I think is a very good thing for a number of reasons, independent of whatever's going on with the Trump administration. I think it's overdue and necessary that they do this, as we've discussed on here plenty before. Those strategic enablers that the U.S. has are the same kind of assets that the Europeans lack most and will continue to lack going forward, even as they build up their militaries, right? It's those really expensive aerial refueling ISR assets that you either have in limited numbers, say like rivet joint aircraft, right? Or aerial refueling aircraft, right? You have them in limited numbers. We have much greater capacity to provide that, right? And as Europe hopefully continues to increase its own defenses, it will still lag in those sectors for a very long period of time. So I think if we're looking at a European-led force to guarantee security for Ukraine after this war is over in that sort of hypothetical scenario, these are the assets that the U.S. would be best positioned to provide that the Europeans could not. And I think that would be something along those lines would be good. And it seems like European leadership and everything is okay with that too. I hope the Trump administration can be kept on board with that. We'll see. But yeah, again, yeah, Everything discussing with them is like, this could be totally changed by tomorrow.
Yeah, this is the unfortunate thing. That's a trap door. I'm just double checking the news right now just to make sure nothing else has come up so far. I mean, the only other big thing in this is Putin came as very emboldened after his visit to China yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, he said that Russia will achieve all aims militarily if Ukraine does not agree to a deal. And, you know, Putin, since meeting Trump, has bombed the crap out of Ukraine multiple times and does not show any signs of backing down. And even Trump has sort of, even his sort of so-called confidence in doing a deal is waning a bit now. So we have very interesting times ahead on this topic, I think.
On any sort of settlement to this war, I do not think we're in the end game for it yet. I think we're perhaps in the beginning of the end still, but I don't think an end is in sight. I don't think we can credibly say that, you know, if there is a deal to end the war, and whenever it ends, it'll end with a deal. In some regard, I don't think we're at the point yet where we can sort of definitively or even with strong ideas say this is probably what it's going to look like. I think we're still sort of too far out for that. But if it's something along these lines, I think we could do far, 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 far worse.
Yeah, indeed. One other quick random note. Forte 10, one of my favorite drones that keep an eye out on flight radar, had a very interesting, busy trip yesterday where it flew for nearly 24 hours and it ended up going across the Finnish border and loitering in the Norwegian Sea to then slowly go back across the Finnish border. And I'm wondering, I'm intrigued to see what that mission was about and whether it's sort of looking at all the things on the Russian border, because obviously now Finland is territory for NATO operations.
Yeah, it was up there looking at the Russian Northern Fleet.
Yeah, without doubt. And so, yeah, some very interesting things going on there as well. So,
did it launch and recover out of, I don't know if you can see this in front of you, do you know if with the mission to Finland, did it launch and recover out of Sigonella or Fairfax?
Yes, it was Sigonella. Okay. Yeah, yeah. None of the drone missions that go over Eastern Europe appear to ever come from the UK. They always seem to come from Sigonella. But the
ones you would see on flight radar.
True. But the ones that you do see come from Mindhall, the rivet joints, which are a bit few and far between these days. And I think they maybe just keeping off flight radar.
I think the tasking, I mean, they get pulled between the Persian Gulf and the Pacific also, you know, so there's a detachment out of, I think it is Mildenhall that they're put out of. But the wing, the 55th wing, that operates all the rivet joint aircraft. That's at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. They forward deploy them, different variants, to Mildenhall sometimes. But they're spread around of Kadena Air Base in Japan. They fly out of the Middle East sometimes. Keep an eye on the Iranians. They're all over the place.
Yeah. And there were some interesting photos of the P-8 Poseidon, which is the anti-submarine plane or maritime surveillance plane.
Yeah.
Where it was over the Black Sea and the Russians photographed it with its sort of radar sensor down in its sort of deployed position, which, the Aviationist had that, and I think the Warzone had that as well. It was very cool. On our Blue Sky, I didn't tweet it. What do you call a Blue Sky post?
Reposted it or something like
that?
What do we call that?
A bleat? I don't know. What do we call that?
They call it a... I still don't know. I believe, at least initially in the very early days of Blue Sky, they were like, call your post here a skeet. You say that you skeet. I'm like, okay. I'm not calling it that.
No, a bleat makes more sense. Yeah, Blue Sky. I'm not grammatically still feels weird. So I don't know.
I'm not calling it that.
My head is a tweet, but in reality, I don't know what it is. But there we go. Well, sticking with the US, obviously we've got another story that you picked out about our favorite DNI, Tulsi Gabbard. So I don't know if you could talk to us a little bit about what's sort of going on there at the moment.
Yeah, it's a story from NBC News about a number of issues that have gone on between the DNI's office and the CIA in the past month or so. It's been bubbling up and getting worse. So tensions at the top of the U.S. intelligence community have burst into the open. According to NBC News, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard blindsided the CIA last month when she revoked a security clearance of a covert officer, publicly naming her in the process. The officer, a veteran analyst who had just prepped the White House for a Trump-Putin summit in Anchorage, was about to take up a new post in Europe, suddenly saw her career ended without warning. CIA officials say they were never properly consulted and were stunned that ODNI failed to recognize her undercover status. It's interesting, though, analysts aren't typically, you wouldn't describe them as officers.
No.
They're not really undercover in the same way unless she was being put to a station in Europe under diplomatic cover or something, then that would be. So I'm a little unclear on the exact nature of, and we really shouldn't be totally clear, but that framing is interesting.
There's something also interesting as well. I don't know whether, because of her experience, whether she was tipped to be the head of the London station, because whoever that was has been pulled as well. Because of comments in a book apparently attributed to them that pissed off Trump.
London station chief is usually given for a long-time career person at the end of their career. It's a cushy spot to go to and round out your service.
Because I'm not clear at the moment who that person was who's been pulled, but they are.
All right. So this latest move is part of a broader purge. 37 current and former officials have lost their clearances on Gabbard's orders, most of them career professionals who worked under Obama and Biden. The justification, Gabbard says, is to root out politicization or weaponization of intelligence. But many of those targeted were linked to the Russia interference assessment or the first Trump impeachment inquiry. among them Yael Eisenstadt, who no longer even held a clearance, has been out of the IC for years, so didn't have a clearance anyway. And Ving Nguyen described as a prodigy at the NSA, and his colleague said was unreplaceable. So this episode has escalated already strained relations between Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe, who has pushed back against her unilateral declassifications and her decision to move preparation of the president's daily brief out of Langley. For former officials, it's not just a turf battle. They warn the hasty revocations amount to weaponizing the clearance process, jeopardizing U.S. capabilities, and potentially putting officers at risk. For Gabbard, though, it's a political win. At a recent cabinet meeting, Trump praised her, saying she's, quote, becoming a bigger and bigger star every day. Observers say the purge looks less like a neutral review of security practices than a campaign to punish perceived disloyalty and reward presidential favor. Chris, what'd you think?
Yeah, I think this is the issue, isn't it? I mean, the scandal aside, revoking the security clearances of 37 people, including experts on Russia, is a hugely political move. And as the article puts it, you know, two former government officials said that their read of the situation is that Gabbard is under pressure to regain President Donald Trump's confidence because Gabbard fell out of favor with Trump and his aides earlier this year over a video, about Iran's nuclear capabilities. And this is the environment of Trump 2.0. Loyalty to President Trump appears to matter more than anything else. And this is hugely dangerous, as Gabbard's actions could well have, you know, deadly consequences in the years ahead with revoking these security clearances. We're approaching the 24th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And, the 9/11 attacks were a result of a communications failure between the CIA and the FBI. And Gabbard's current role, the DNI, was established to prevent such intelligence failures from happening again. And instead, she appears to be revoking security clearances of vital and experienced people in the intelligence community to curry favor with the president. And on top of that, they managed to publicly out someone. And so it just shows they're not very good or even coordinated in what they're doing. And former CIA officer Alex Finley, who's now an author, was just doing an interview that I was watching yesterday. And she mentioned that, you know, it's concerning that they cannot handle information about their own people correctly. And it kind of shows a stunning lack of coordination with the ODNI.
Right.
And then just to go to the kind of the bigger picture, obviously, this isn't great for the special relationship right now, because there's a lot of nervous people in British intelligence and European intelligence about people in American intelligence now, because it is becoming more politicized. It is becoming more the Trump agency. And there was a great piece by Gordon Carrera in The Observer about UK spy chiefs being spooked about this veteran CIA officer who's unnamed, who was tipped to be the station chief in London, who was then suddenly removed from the role due to a quote in the book that supporters of Trump believed to be unfavorable to Trump. And as Gordon pointed out in his piece, and this is quite a good quote here, it was just the latest sign of politics creeping into intelligence that has left allies worried. Ask Britain's most senior spies and national security officials how the relationship with the US is faring, and they assure you everything is fine. But even their best poker faces cannot mask the unease. It is all smiley faces on the surface, but beneath that there is real anxiety, as one British official put it. And he also added that intelligence officials have long emphasized that whatever the political headwinds, the working relationship between professionals endures. That held true through the first Trump administration, despite the odd rocky moment. But for those hoping to keep their heads down for 4 years with Trump 2.0, it does not feel that way anymore. Trump 2.0 is different. And, you know, this is the thing. It is loyalty over the truth. Truth to power seems to be the old motto now. Boring.
I think this is ultimately, I mean, the consequences of it aside, I think this is ultimately due to Gabbard trying to hold on to her job and curry favor with the president. As you said, she took a hit a couple months ago around the post about on her personal YouTube channel, post about Hiroshima, the Hiroshima Museum. And there was some certainly daylight between her and the administration on the Iran strikes. And yeah, I think this is her trying to keep her job and curry favor by sort of taking an axe to anyone who touched any assessment of Russia's interference in the 2016 elections, anything having to do with, you know, Ukraine and that relationship that sort of resulted in the first impeachment inquiry. So she's, you know, going after anyone, any scalp that she can serve up to keep her job. And that's what I would read, you know, as far as people who have been out of the IC for years and no longer have active clearances anyway, them being thrown on a list also. I think it's that's sloppiness for one. But I think it's also just, you know, okay, these are the names that are going around in sort of the MAGA fever swamps online of people we don't like. Okay, we'll just slap them on the list again. I think it's yeah. No deeper than that. But again, you know, yeah, the damage, of course, is very real. Another thought I had, though, CIA was, I think, largely spared some of the worst political games of Trump's first term, right? Gina Haspel I discussed this with Tim Weider in my interview with him earlier in the summer about The Mission, his new book, The Mission. You know, Gina Haspel did a lot to shield the CIA, especially in those last couple, in that last year of Trump's term, and has not gotten the recognition that I think she deserves. She did in Tim's book, especially. But I wonder if how well they will be shielded again in the second term. And of course, early indications are certainly not to the same extent. You know, how deep will the cuts continue at CIA? I don't know. If there's anything that interests me, and this is something I would want to potentially ask someone like, you know, Shane Harris or other people we know who are somewhat connected to the intelligence community, or at least reporting on it. The relationship that John Ratcliffe has with the rest of the administration, I find interesting. In the first term, he was one of the president's loudest boosters. He's a congressman, didn't really have any experience in intelligence or national security at all. He had a few viral Fox News clips of, you know, him telling off people who went crosswise of Trump's agenda at congressional hearings and stuff. And that essentially got him the job as DNI. He served as DNI for a little bit in the first Trump administration, now back as CIA director. But I find it's not to say that he's, you know, innocent and hasn't been involved in anything like this over the course of the second term so far. I just found him to be quieter. You know, as compared to someone like Gabbard, you know, or Hegseth, you know, some of this real, like, you know, firebrand, like doing everything they can to prostrate themselves in front of Trump, like, please love me, sir. I haven't seen him doing much like that. And I'm just curious, to the extent that there is some effort to shield CIA from the rest of the administration, What does that look like now? That's an open question of mine. But I think this sheds light into that. And also keep in mind, in this reporting, it's very much noted that Ratcliffe is not happy about what Gabbard's doing.
Yeah, which in some ways is reassuring. But we will see, because if he was happy, that would be concerning.
Right. Again, I don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes with them. I just indications outsider looking in right now, that's something that I find to be interesting there. Also, bear in mind, you know, Gabbard has presidential ambitions of her own for 2028. Clearly intends to. I think this came up last conversation I had with Shane Harris on the air here, that Gabbard has presidential ambitions for 2028. And so her keeping in the administration's good side, at least having the sort of respect and admiration of the president's base to the extent that she can have it, would be valuable to her going forward.
Yeah, I was wondering what her end game is, because obviously she was a veteran who then kind of went on a sort of anti-war card, didn't she, with originally with the Democrats, and then a lot of Democrats were suspicious of her, and then eventually their suspicions were confirmed because she became very Trumpy.
She got into tanky territory.
Yeah, yeah. She's very much the walking embodiment of the horseshoe theory in some respect.
Yeah. No, her, if there are three people in the administration right now that I would expect to have actively have their eyes on 2028 right now, it would be her, RFK Jr., and Vance.
Yeah.
I think all three of them want to run.
Maybe we should put them all in a room together and let them figure it out. But
break a broomstick in half, like the Joker.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. We will see what happens with that one. So, yeah, again, interesting times ahead. So, God, that could even happen before the British election. It probably will. Yeah.
It will. Yeah.
It will. So, God, 2028, 2029 could be a very interesting period of time. Mm-hmm. There we go. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add, or are you?
No, definitely one to keep an eye on. I don't like seeing stuff like this. I think it's really harmful to our national security. Anyone who thinks that they are made safer by shit like this is dead wrong. You know, not good.
No, it isn't. Well, let's take our final break and we'll come back for our final story.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back, everybody. So our next story is one I picked out about a soldier who admitted spying against New Zealand by trying to give military base maps to a foreign country. And this is by Jeremy Wilkinson from the New Zealand Herald. Now, I will just say I didn't recall seeing the country named as to who he was supposedly spying for. So
I have thoughts on that.
I have my guesses. It feels a bit like Top Gun 2, but
I'm torn. I have my guesses. I'll let you explain. Okay.
I suspect we're probably in the same place, but we'll see. So a New Zealand soldier whose name remains suppressed has pleaded guilty to attempting to spy by offering military base maps and other sensitive information to what he thought was a foreign official. The foreign contact was actually an undercover police officer, and across several meetings in late 2019, the soldier handed over restricted documents, base directories, and even wrote a security assessment of Linton Military Camp. Police began investigating him after the Christchurch mosque attacks, linking him to far-right groups like the Dominion Movement and Action New Zealander. The soldier insisted that those groups were just community groups and denied supporting violence. When his home was searched, police found a hard drive containing the banned Christchurch shooting video, which I believe was originally live streamed on Facebook when it happened. And then they also found a copy of the attacker's manifesto, which, you know, led to further charges. And this is the second time in New Zealand's history that a soldier has faced an espionage-related charge. And this case has taken 5 years to come to trial after his initial arrest in 2020, which I must admit surprised me it took this long. I have no idea why that is. But Matt, any thoughts on this story?
Yeah, I was just trying to pull up the text of the article again here so I could be sort of
correct about this. So I believe, okay, reading from the article here, in 2019, it says, in 2019, the New Zealand government became aware that a soldier had made contact with a third party indicating he was a soldier who wanted to defect. Okay, so that tells me, reading between the lines here, the New Zealand government was notified, hey, one of your soldiers contacted this third party, this other government, right, and said that they wanted to defect, right? Then, in November, he was contacted by an undercover officer pretending to be an official from a foreign country, and he agreed to meet the person in Palmerston North, right?
So, question, do you think there's a SIGINT thing here or something else? Yes.
I do. I believe it was some sort of a SIGINT or a counterintelligence thing that some other, perhaps Five Eyes country, noticed that this New Zealand soldier was trying to contact someone they shouldn't have and notified the New Zealand government, hey, take an eye, you know, look at your guy, see what he's doing. And then they put together a CI operation, a sting to draw him in further and to prosecute him. I think as far as which country was involved here, what third country was involved here, I think, third country, I believe, was a Five Eyes member. I can't say beyond that. What country this soldier offered to defect to, again, totally speculating here, does not say. The far-right connections and the offer to defect, of course, would suggest Russia.
It would,
however, if I was to pick a adversary country that has the most current operational need for this intelligence about New Zealand's military facilities, it would be China.
Mm. Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the two can't and don't share intake along these things. Mm. I mean, yeah, if you're a New Zealand official soldier person and you're offering up information to the Russians, could just as easily end up in the hands of the Chinese as well. That was my take on it. I will say though, you can learn an awful lot from telephone directories of military facilities. I have a library. I have a library of them. I keep a library of them.
I'm assuming it's a legal library and not...
It's for U.S. facilities. It's for U.S. facilities. They're not classified or marked restricted in any way. I have them because they found their way on the internet in some other way. I didn't put them on the internet. I didn't illegally access, you know, defense networks to get a hold of them. Usually you can find them, at least in the U.S., you can find them. There's a lot of support groups for military families and stuff, you know, like newcomer guide to whatever Air Force base. Here's what you need to know. And in the back of it, there's a whole extensive telephone book. It's interesting what you can find out there. And totally unrestricted. There's no restrictions on these guides whatsoever being out there. Of course, it wouldn't be the ones I have, there aren't names on them. It's just like the organizational unit, usually with like there's like an organizational code, like a staff code or something, like a J32 division, right? Inside the operations directorate at, I don't know, some combatant command or whatever, right? Stuff like that. But it would have like the number, like the phone number, like the extension, but there would be no names. Of course, I'm not interested in that sort of stuff. These guides are, and the intelligence interest in it, I immediately recognize that because like I collect these things for the same reason. You can learn a lot about how a organization is structured by those guides and how the different moving parts within it all sort of function together and who does what. It's very useful to learn stuff like that. And then, of course, you can also use it if you have the resources and the time and the need, you can use it to work backwards and gather information that you shouldn't have. I just like to know how things are structured.
Yeah, as I'm sure the Russians and Chinese would too. So it's, very interesting one. I wonder, just because the far right thing, maybe I'm wrong here, whether it was Russia, but then at the same time, after visiting New Zealand, why would you want to defect to Russia? But That's a whole other, you know, because New Zealand is such a beautiful country. But I don't know, it's a bizarre one, that one. But certainly the far right thing definitely falls into what we've talked about in previous episodes about other spy scandals.
Right.
That there very much is a weakness going on within the military and the intelligence world, where far right leaning, or should we say right leaning people who end up leaning a bit too far right, end up becoming vulnerable to Russian intelligence operations. And you know, and that's happened in Germany, happened in Britain. Well, I had a British man in British embassy guard in Germany fell foul of this, and some of the recent trials that took place, that there has been found that there's been sort of far-right leanings of British members of the public who end up helping Russia with sabotage operations and things like that. So, you know, it's definitely the new profile, because in the 70s and 80s, it was probably the far leftist spying for communist Russia, but that was 60s, 70s and 80s and all that, but it's changed now.
Should also underscore here, he said in this soldier in New Zealand, said that he was not affiliated with the far right, and that these sort of groups that he was sort of connected to, that he was charged with being connected to, it's just sort of community support and everything. However, I find it, I think, a sort of giveaways here. He had the Christchurch shooters manifesto on his computer, which is restricted in New Zealand. You're not supposed to have that.
Yep.
Having a manifesto alone, I mean, yeah, if you're like a researcher, you know, like a terrorism researcher or something, like me, I don't. But if I had that manifesto on my computer, that research for something, it's not...
Well, in the UK, that could put you in wonky territory.
Right, right. Careful, but that's not restricted here. But if you're, unless you're like a university-affiliated researcher or something, that can get tricky for you. You also had the video of the shooting, which I don't see how you could square that, even as a researcher. Like, I don't, outside of a law enforcement setting, I don't know why you would have that if you're not, if you're not a far-right person or not inclined in that way. That makes no sense to me at all.
No, he's definitely gone and made a great effort to go and get that, because it was removed officially from the internet very
quickly.
Yeah,
you got to go like on the dark web to get that.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. So no, very, very strange case. I'm sure more will kind of come out as time comes on. Just a kind of quick few notes just about what the Dominion movement is and the Action New Zealander, or sorry, Action Zealander. So the Dominion movement was a short-lived far-right group in New Zealand that emerged in 2018, and it was inspired by the European Identitarian movement. It promoted white nationalist ideas, opposed immigration, consumerism, and transgender rights, and framed itself as defending the interests of the so-called white New Zealanders. Its activities were mostly limited to postering and banner drops and outdoor gatherings designed to build a sense of community among its young white male members. The group itself shut down in 2019, in March 2019, after the Christchurch mosque attacks, claiming to condemn the violence but insisting no link on the perpetrator. But I do know that there was an immediate crackdown on far-right groups in New Zealand after that, so that's probably more likely why they shut down. And then you've got Action Zealander, which was founded later in 2019 and is a successor to the Dominion movement, and remains New Zealand's most active white nationalist group. But when I looked into it, it's not exactly a large group. It sort of had like 30 to 100 sort of active members. So it's not that massive, at least if the numbers I've read are correct. But it does recruit young men, emphasizes physical fitness, environmentalism, which is another interesting thing, the far right and the environment. Again, possibly a future episode there. And the belief that European New Zealanders face demographic replacement through immigration, which is ironic. And then the group presents itself as a cultural and community movement, carrying out lissapics, bushwalks, and propaganda campaigns such as posters and online videos. While it officially rejects violence, members have been connected to threats against mosques, espionage cases, and international extremist networks. So, you know, analysts describe it as a paramilitary-style organization seeking to normalize white nationalist ideas within mainstream politics, which is kind of what we were talking about before, about how these far-right groups are not stupid. And, you know, just looking at the whole thing about they do litter picks and bushwalks and things like that, you know, fascists love and are very cleverly find very innocuous local issues.
Look at the flags.
Yeah.
And we're just hanging flags.
try and dominate them and get seen as the person who did this. So I'll use the example of potholes. A local councillor might become obsessed about potholes. He might be a far-right local councillor, and eventually he might lead to some positive action, get those potholes filled in. So people start to see, oh, that guy is not the fascist. He's the man who dealt with the potholes. And you kind of then forget the nasty politics behind that individual because he is the man who dealt with the potholes. And this is the problem. The majority of the public aren't really nerdy enough to know that this man's a fascist. They just see him as the pothole man. And this is the danger of far-right groups and even far-left groups too, and extremists in general. They're always kind of cleverly are trying to push talking points into the mainstream and get them normalized. And that's all in, you know, in the 10 seasons of this podcast, what I have noticed increasingly is these, you know, how extremist talking points are becoming much more normalized than ever before. And it's really worrying because it is changing our societies. And just looking at New Zealand for a moment, just because we were talking about this earlier, you know, the culture wars in New Zealand, you know, from what I've read, it appears that extremism in New Zealand is being fueled from both ends of the political spectrum. On one side, you've got these far-right groups that we've been talking about who push white nationalist ideas and conspiracy theories like the Great Replacement, whilst on the other side, you've got the hardline anti-colonial narratives who emphasize systematic oppression and frame the nation as almost entirely through the lens of colonial harm. And each side kind of feed off each other, and they create a cycle of reciprocal radicalization that polarizes debates and makes compromise difficult. For many New Zealanders, this has turned complex questions about identity, history, and belonging into stark us versus them battles, deepening cultural divides instead of encouraging a constructive dialogue. And this is the thing, it's all about narratives. And if the far right present a narrative of social cohesion, whilst the far left present a narrative of, oh, we've got to break society apart, the far right will win. And this again is my problem with the left. I'm noticing again and again and again a rise of this, on the back of anti-colonialism, this sort of rise of fracturing societies and so on. And I think it's sort of, maybe I'm wrong and I might be the wrong person to be saying this, but I just feel like it sort of is getting to a point where it's getting more and more ridiculous every year. And slowly some of these ideas are becoming more and more mainstream, and we're seeing more and more people getting fractured and bent out of shape with each other than we ever have before. You know, and yeah. This started in 2016. I mean, this goes back, you know, God, almost decades really. And it, you know, probably goes back to the beginning of the early 2000s with the rise of Fox News and internet culture, etc. But it just feels like the political extremes are getting louder and louder and louder. When you look at the numbers, the people who drive these narratives are actually a minority, but they get all the attention online, which then kind of puts us out of a sense of proportion. Because when you deal with people on the streets on a regular interpersonal basis, I mean, like, I've been doing a lot of street photography this year, and honestly, it's been one of the most amazingly positive things I've ever done, because I'm suddenly in conversations with complete strangers, and the real world isn't that bad outside of the internet.
That's true.
That's the funny thing. It really isn't. That's true. People are generally quite nice. And when you spend all your time looking at the internet, you kind of feel like the whole world is about to implode and everybody's in their little silos. And I think we just need to get a bit of perspective back. And I just sometimes feel the far right and the far left are making things more and more difficult for everybody. And the problem is right now with the rise of fascism and authoritarianism with Trump and Farage, it is allowing us to adopt more far-left positions and see them less as problematic. So that's where I'm kind of coming from a little bit.
Yeah.
And I want to explore that in proper depth, because obviously, you know, I might be wrong in some of this, but I feel like that is what's going on. That's the way I read the situation at this time. And it, you know, like what you were saying earlier about people saying you shouldn't use the American flag anymore, etc. And I just don't see how we get out of this negativity and kind of find a level of social cohesion where the society functions for everybody.
I want to say though that the idea that to fly an American flag in front of your house or to bring one to an anti-Trump protest isn't like that's a fascist. The idea that someone's saying that is a fascist symbol and you shouldn't do that is just like, that is not a popular position in this country or yours or in any country. Like, that is not like, one, as I said, don't say that ever out loud ever. Even if you don't believe it, you shouldn't believe it, but never say it again because Fox News will pick it up and make it seem like everyone who opposes Trump or opposes the far right thinks that. Not true. No, dumb. Don't say that. But it's stuff like that, that you make it seem like, oh, well, this is what, you know, everyone sort of has these fringe crazy ideas. I mean, I through August a bit, parts of August and also parts of through parts of the summer, I pulled back from social media a lot on, I mean, Blue Sky is the one that I'm active on the most, but I just found that it's just noise and panic and just everything dialed up to the 100th degree. And that's not to say that there isn't reason. There are very good reasons for people to be upset and angry and scared. And yes, completely, completely, completely true there. I just don't think it's good to marinate in it 24/7. And I don't think more than that, I think I've almost sworn off cable news completely. I think that's a drug. It doesn't help you understand the moment that we're in, you know? And I think you just have to be really careful about the kind of people you listen to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you've got fascists destroying your country, it doesn't help if then the people on the left are also trying to reframe the country and semi-destroy it in another way either. It's sort of like two arsonists trying to burn down a house. And like, this is the problem I'm finding.
You have to be, I think you have to be really objective. And you have to be really objective, and you have to make sure, I think, that whatever sort of, what's the word, assessment that you're making about the state of the country and the people in the country where they are, I think it's very easy to form that opinion based on poorly colored data.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And that's something that I'm being very hard. Yeah. I'm trying hard to avoid. And I think a trap there is to overly rely on people who just tell you what you want to hear. Whether that's everything's great, he's going to die any minute, don't worry, or whether that's everything's awful and, you know, the National Guard is in the street and it's all over and, you know, so long for democracy. I think each of those are harmful in their own ways. And if you just look at all of that for one or the other, because you're a total neurotic, you know, afraid and a mess about that, not to say that people don't have reason to be, they do.
Yeah.
Looking at that extreme, you know, the doomerism, that's also harmful, but also looking at the constant, you know, like he's going to die any minute because of this, you know, blurry picture that was shot from like a mile away or something on a golf course. That's also bad. Like, you're not helping yourself understand what's happening right now. And it doesn't lead to anything good.
That kind of reminds me of the hope of the Mueller report, where it got to this point where it got so overblown.
The deus ex machina of it, yeah.
Yeah, and even though the Mueller report still brought out some very valuable information, but that all got lost in everybody's disappointment that it didn't lead to, you know, Trump being marched out of the White House by the FBI, because that's the way some people positioned it. You know, this is the end of Trump, you know. And it wasn't, but it doesn't mean the Mueller report didn't find things that were very problematic, but, you know, for another podcast. But oh, dear. So, we live in strange times right now.
I think
now.
You should fly a Union Jack from your flat, Chris.
I was thinking from an art direction point of view, but I'm not quite sure where I should put it. And I'm not sure my wife.
No, I think it should be visible to people in the neighborhood.
True. But I was thinking we should get a special relationship flag where it's the American and the British one in the corner here. I could just about fit it there, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I might have to put it up and take it down for every podcast because it might not. My wife might get a bit pissed off with me having this massive kind of almost political style flag.
That's fair.
That's fair. Be like very politics, my political campaign, you know. Yeah, no, totally. Well, the politics of flags, what a time we're in. But no, it's been quite the summer, we need to probably should get a flag of some description, but might hold fire on it just yet for this to cool down, but I don't know, we'll see. That might be a household discussion to be had. But
don't let them have it. They don't own it.
No.
They don't have a right to it exclusively. It doesn't mean what they want it to mean. And you can help ensure that by using it yourself and co-opting it.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And we need to find ways to do that. And maybe that's our mission ahead. So there we go. Cool, man. Well, I think that kind of brings us to the end for today. So if anybody is still out there listening, thank you. It's great to be back. It's nice to be doing this again. So thank you, Matt. And I will catch you on the next one. And thank you again, everybody, for listening. And don't forget to connect with us on Blue Sky Threads and Instagram. That's where we are. And I think it's just all at Secrets and Spies. You can also watch us on YouTube. There is a link in the show notes. Also, I'm running an introduction to podcasting course on the 22nd of September in my hometown of Guildford. And that's at the Guildford Institute. So there'll be a link in the show notes. And somewhere in this podcast, there's an ad I've already recorded that if you haven't skipped the ads, you might hear. If you have skipped the ads, check out the first ad break so you get my ad there about the podcast course. So that's it. So thank you so much, Matt. And we're now into season 10. So very exciting times ahead.
Yes.
So,
yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cool. I'll see you next time. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Take care.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts. Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.